Jesus, the Messiah, King of Kings and Lord of Lords, God in flesh, crucified, died, buried, raised on the third day for the forgiveness of sin. This is Apologetics Profile, a weekly podcast equipping you to engage the world of non-Christian ideas, beliefs, and spiritual practices.
A few summers ago, we here at Watchman Fellowship hosted the best-selling author and New Testament scholar, Dr. Bart Ehrman, on our ministry's Atheist and Christian Book Club. Dr. Ehrman, if you don't know, identifies himself as an agnostic atheist and does not believe Jesus actually rose from the dead. So we asked him during our club meeting what he thought really happened. Here is Dr. Bart Ehrman's response.
I think what happened is that one or more of them, sometime later, thought that they had a vision of Jesus of some kind. They had a vision. The word vision does not necessarily mean hallucination. The word vision comes from the Latin word "video," which just means to see. If you see a tree outside your window, that's a vision. You're seeing it, but it's a true vision. It's something that's actually there. Lots of people see things that aren't there. One out of eight of us, so three of us here on this call, will see a dead relative in our lives, and we'll be convinced that this person really appeared to us. One out of eight people have this experience. Your aunt dies, and 2 weeks later, you see her in your bed. It happens all the time. There's a large psychological scholarship on non-veridical visions, which means visions that, you know, people are just seeing things. It happens with groups. Large groups of people see things all the time. There are lots of Roman Catholic groups, up to 500 people, who see the Blessed Virgin Mary, and they'll all swear they saw her. So my view is that the disciples of Jesus believed, some of them believed they saw visions of they believed they saw Jesus after his death. And they convinced the others. If you're a Christian, as you are, then the simple solution is that Jesus appeared to them. Jesus appeared to them. If you're non-Christian, you'd say they thought they saw Jesus. Both things happen all the time. My view is that Jesus did not appear to them because I do not believe Jesus was raised from the dead. I don't even think that Jesus was put into a tomb.
Ehrman is not fully committed to the position of hallucinations as being the cause of what the disciples claimed to see regarding Jesus after his death. He does believe they saw something, but remains fairly convinced it was not an actual bodily resurrection from the dead. Our guest again this week, Dr. Daryl Bach, the Senior Research Professor of New Testament Studies and the Executive Director for Cultural Engagement at Dallas Theological Seminary, suggests that hallucinations remain a somewhat viable explanation among more liberal scholars, though few would be fully committed to the idea.
The reason the hallucination discussion is popular is because that and a kind of, how can I say this, a kind of passing on of that experience can explain how you could get a mass of people going in the direction of planting a church and saying Jesus is raised from the dead. They really believed it. They believed it so much they would have died for the idea, you know, that kind of idea. But if you ask me what really happened, oh, don't take me there. I don't know what to say. Okay, that's actually oftentimes what's said. I don't know what to say.
The chief difficulty for many scholars today is in accepting the miraculous aspects of God with us in Christ. As C. Stephen Evans points out, quote, "Whatever else may be true of the incarnational narrative, it is abundantly clear that it is full of apparently miraculous and supernatural elements. In the Gospels, Jesus is represented as having a miraculous birth, being born of a virgin, with angels appearing to announce and celebrate the occasion. In his public ministry, Jesus shows supernatural knowledge and performs many miracles and exorcisms. Finally, and most crucially, his execution is followed by his own resurrection from the dead. One could hardly argue that the narrative as a whole is reliable if all the miracle stories are historically false. The Church, however, has always regarded the resurrection of Jesus as its very foundation. For better or worse, the story seems inextricably tied to the miraculous, and a world that has difficulty believing in miracles cannot help but have difficulty accepting such a narrative as historical. End quote. That comes from Evan's 1996 book, The Historical Christ and the Jesus of Faith, The Incarnational Narrative as History, on Oxford University Press. What then is the consequence for a majority of us who are not New Testament scholars? How can we respond to widespread scholarly skepticism about the miracles in the Bible in a thoughtful and sensible way? I admit it was at times a little daunting to talk to Bart Ehrman a few years ago on our book club, and most of us simply don't have the kind of background knowledge of the text as someone like Ehrman does. It can be quite intimidating, so much so that we can easily back away from such discussions. Bach suggests, however, taking a more strategic program of carefully listening to our skeptical interlocutors to understand their intellectual furniture, the assumptions behind their epistemological toolkits, for the sake of finding common ground and building a conceptual bridge.
I'm thinking through, where is that person who I'm interacting with? Where are they coming from? What categories do they have? What's driving them? It's turning me into a listener to them a little more. And as I engage with them and I see how they see the world, et cetera, I'm beginning to ask the question, all right, what bridges can I build that will open up a conversation that will take them in a direction that allows me to raise the things that I'm aware of that they may not be aware of.
As we begin part two, Daryl explains how deeply our perceptions of how we see and interpret the world impact how we read and interpret the Bible. Here once again is Dr. Daryl Bach.
This is true of everybody. The lenses that we wear not only allow us to bring things into focus, but they also prevent us from seeing certain things.
Right, right.
And so the lenses of a worldview that says that God is not active in the world and miracles don't happen means that when I hit a miracle, I've got another explanation for what's happening in the text, and I don't see some of what I might need to deal with. So I think that's what's happening here, is that you get this, based upon what their perception of what's believable is, et cetera, you get this sifting process that happens with the material. And someone who's a conservative and says the Bible is inspired and it's all true, et cetera, those miracles happened, et cetera. You know, we're putting all that data into our database, all right? They are taking that material and saying, that doesn't count. That's not a part of the conversation. And so that's what's producing the difference.
So analogously to, say, maybe astronomy, the technology of telescope lenses or mirrors. Traditionally, the early telescopes, you had to close one eye to look through the lens to see what was going on. Of course, the telescope technology, yep, being what it is today, doesn't require you squinting. It seems to be what you're saying there, in a sense that whatever the tool that we've made for ourselves, the analytical tool, has within it certain ideological presuppositions that prevent us from actually looking at the data in a more full and realistic context.
Yeah, and of course the other part of the debate is that you know, who isn't subject to those limitations,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm,
and what justifies the adoption of one worldview approach to the way to see the Bible versus another? Those are also parts of the conversation. That's when you move into the philosophical apologetic space.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is with those kinds of questions. But the other set of questions that's also triggering conversation is what's happening in the texts and how we got the texts and where they came from and all those kinds of questions. And in the popular apologetic world, those conversations aren't as prevalent, and they're also harder to conduct because most people don't have the background to engage, much less follow those conversations.
Right. And I will raise my hand and say that I years ago, I was one of them. I still feel like, despite what I have come to know that I still feel quite ignorant. I took a year of Greek and Hebrew in seminary, but hardly adequate to be considered an expert in this. But I thought, given what we're talking about here, Daryl, I thought I'd sample two kinds of lenses that exist, one from the not so distant past and one from contemporary time.
Okay.
I'll start with, I'll give you two and then you can comment on, and I think these are representative of a kind of lens that is within the dialogue, and correct me if they're not, but I want to start with the late Gerd Ludemann at the end of his book, Resurrection of Jesus. He starts the sixth chapter with this quote: "We can no longer understand the resurrection of Jesus in a literal sense." And I'll just stop there and kind of let that hang. And then I want to go to Dale Allison. We had Dale Allison on our Atheist and Christian Book Club last year, and a wonderful, effable man. He's just a great guy. Fun
a
to
delight. No, he's a delightful conversation
fun,
partner.
Fun to talk to. And we talked about his book. Let's see what it was. What did we talk about?
We talked about the resurrection.
We talked about the historical Christ and the theological Jesus. That's the book we talked about. But in it, there was this is a sort of a representative quote that you can comment on. He says this, something akin to what Ludemann has said: "The New Testament offers no precognitive history of eschatological future. The New Jerusalem, the Last Judgment, and the resurrection are, just like Eden, the serpent, and Adam, theological parables. We must interpret them not literally, but as religious poetry, which means with our theologically informed imaginations." So it seems to be that there is a kind of, I think Dale identifies as a Christian. I think Gerd did too, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe he did or didn't. I don't know. But it seems that in those two quotes, maybe as bookends for one of the more bigger conclusions of liberal New Testament criticism, they come to the conclusion that we can't read the resurrection literally, basically. How do you sample both of these?
Yeah, and this is where I was in a debate with Marcus Borg at North Texas with Bill Lane Craig. This was years ago.
Okay.
And he was making similar kinds of statements.
Mm.
And so I said to him, this isn't as vague as you are suggesting. And I took him to a text in 2 Maccabees, which is an intertestamental Jewish text, which is going through the martyrdom of seven sons of a mother who, as the Jews are being executed one at a time by Antiochus Epiphanes and his team.
Mm-hmm.
And they're being mutilated and killed and dismembered in front of their mother. Okay, it's a pretty gruesome text.
Mm.
When they get to son number three, he holds out his hands and sticks out his tongue and says, "You can have these because one day God will give them back to me." Okay? And I said, we know what the Jews thought resurrection was. We know how they distinguish it from immortality of the soul, etc. So this is not a blank slate that we are walking into. This is something that has background, and there is a form of physicality to it. Now, I'll complicate that picture. We also have 1 Corinthians 15, which tells us that the resurrection body, even though it's physical and material in some sense, isn't exactly like the body we have now. Okay? So there's something different about it. And there's a little bit of a hint in the resurrection appearances, because Jesus can show up and you don't have to open the door. He doesn't have to knock and open the door for him to get in the room. So that kind of thing. And in fact, the background in Judaism is we're going to be more like angels in our resurrected body. So now the question becomes, what does literal mean? And how do we conceive of what that is, that kind of thing? But let's also talk about what we're affirming. We're affirming there's a level of identity between the physical body that we have now and the resurrection body that we will get. There is a very clear, identifiable characteristic to that resurrection body. You're gonna know it's me and not you, okay? And those kinds of things. Well, that's bigger than saying, well, the resurrection is some kind of a metaphor that we have to adopt. I actually think, and I don't know how recently you've interviewed Dale, but I've seen him on programs where he has admitted, first of all, he admits the possibility of miracle, which is a step in the right kind of direction. And I think he has ended up in a kind of place where he goes, my faith tells me God's going to do something, but don't ask me what it is.
Mm. Yeah, that was consistent with our conversation with him last year.
Okay. Yeah. So it's the layer of specificity that he's going to give that's going to be a problem. So you're going to meet, so here's my point in raising that. You're going to meet liberals or non-conservatives who are kind of all over the map. They're not all going to be in the same place. Some will say more than others, if I can say it that way, mm-hmm. from our perspective, that kind of thing. And so you, and this works against, against absorbing a generalization too much that says, well, all liberals are the same.
Yes, right. Do you think, I want to go to another example here, who's a big voice in this conversation, and that is of Rudolf Bultmann. And the program of demythologizing that he is known for. And I want to read a little bit of a snippet from Leslie Newbegin's book, Foolishness to the Greeks. Newbegin says that Bultmann's idea is, in this, it is fully recognized that the plausibility structure of traditional religious faith simply collapses in the atmosphere of secular urban society. So how much, Daryl, do you think, not only in Bultmann's thought, but in modernity today, that the way our culture is in general, a very technologically oriented, scientific, maybe holdover of a kind of a logical positivism, empiricism, how much of the air of modernity that we breathe casts doubt upon the kind of hermeneutic we bring to the texts? How much is modernity?
I think it casts a lot of doubt. I mean, Bultmann is known for saying, in the era of the light bulb, it's hard to believe what the Bible is saying. And the point that he's trying to make that actually has an element of reflection embedded in it is, we know a lot more about the reality that is around us than ancients did. We know how things work. You know, we can examine a cell. We can look at DNA. You know, just keep going. We can reach out. We can reach out into the universe and see how vast it is. All those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Ancients didn't know that. So in the back of his mind, he may be saying there could be an explanation for the way things work that the ancients just didn't have categories for. So they attribute it to God.
Gotcha. So it's a God of the gaps hermeneutic.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So that's where he's coming from in and demythologizing is really nothing but applying the, if I can say this, the miracles don't happen perspective to, and I don't know how to process the language about spiritual beings in a way that still gives human value to the stories that are told. There's something that's resonating in the Bible that even liberals recognize has something to say about life.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Whether they accept the history or not, they are saying this has things to tell us that are worth knowing and reflecting on.
Right.
Which is an odd irony in this conversation.
Yes, yes. There's still a nugget of substance to think and consider about, which is why these...
Yeah, so I often get asked the question, so tell me why a liberal even bothers with this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's if they don't believe it, then why do they talk about it? Well, it's because there's something in there they actually do believe, and there's something in there that they think is of value. And so so that becomes the backdrop for some of these conversations. And it's in all honesty, because I work in the professional guild and I'm around people like this all the time, it gives me a basis for conversation because there isn't a total disconnect in many cases with where people are and what they're wrestling with. I've strayed from the way you've raised the demythologizing thing, but I'm trying to explain that the whole point of demythologizing is after you're done with the demythologizing, there's something there to talk about that's of substance.
There's still something left, and Bultmann is not doing the Richard Dawkins and just tearing the whole thing down.
It's right. He's not being dismissive at all. And so there's that element to the conversation. But the demythologizing is really an application, simply an application of the kind of lens Bultmann was already reading the text with. It's just the next step.
Gotcha. Gotcha. It reminds me of a quote from Charles Dickens in, to be seasonal here, A Christmas Carol, where Scrooge encounters Marley's ghost for the first time. And Dickens, as the narrator, says, "The truth is that Scrooge tried to be smart as a means of distracting his own attention and keeping down his terror, for the specter's voice disturbed the very marrow in his bones."
Yeah, and I think that part of the challenge here is that is how do we get people who have absorbed all of this, maybe not truly reflectively, but by default, to think about the idea that may not be the only option.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in the short time we have remaining, Daryl, I know that probably my listeners are wondering about, well, ask him about Bart Ehrman. We don't care about all these dead German guys. Seriously, we had Dr. Ehrman on our book club as well. It was a couple summers ago, and I had a brief moment to interact with him. But I thought we could focus, because Bart seems to be a kind of, a product of this long involved discussion since Strauss, and maybe even before Strauss, about skepticism and history and what we can know and what we can't know. And Bart is a wonderful case study, because he will do something like affirm that James is the brother of Jesus. It's right there in the text. Can't you see it? But when it comes to Damascus Road or Mary at the tomb or the Jesus eating fish, or, you know, he'll say that they saw something, but he doesn't think that Jesus was put in a tomb or even rose out of the tomb or rose from the dead. It doesn't seem like he's interested in committing full bore to what the disciples actually saw, but he will offer a kind of grief hallucination explanation, but he's not entirely committed to it. He's just like, well, it's possible.
Yeah, this is not an unusual scholarly position for those who work in Jesus studies. Their position is the disciples really believed that Jesus was risen from the dead. We just don't know what that experience was. Okay. So when, you know, remember I said there are two key questions. You've got to be able to explain what Jesus got crucified and how we got the church. This is getting at the how we got the church question. We got to the church question because disciples came to believe that the cross was not the end. And then, in fact, Jesus had, in some sense, appeared to them. And the reason the hallucination discussion is popular is because that and a kind of, how can I say this, a kind of passing on of that experience can explain how you could get a mass of people going in the direction of planting a church and saying Jesus is raised from the dead. They really believed it. They believed it so much they would have died for the idea, you know, that kind of idea. But if you ask me what really happened, oh, don't take me there. I don't know what to say. Okay. That's actually oftentimes what's said. I don't know what to say. And so when they say it isn't literal, I think sometimes what they may mean is it doesn't have to be literal. There are other explanations for how we could get here, and they're more inclined to believe those. Bart Ehrman often says, this is actually things we personally interact with each other. He'll say, well, I can't rule out a miracle entirely. It's just, and I am paraphrasing, I just have to go through all the other options before I get there, you know, and, which means he never gets there.
Yeah.
And so, so that's the way he approached it. Well, that's very much like the lens I started off talking about. He's allowed the door to have a crack in it where a little beam of light might come through, but that door's not open.
Gotcha. Now I say, for lack of a better word, nervous to make a commitment for, because of the paucity of textual evidence that would be problematic in trying to, you know, I mean,
I'm really hesitant to talk about speculating on what the motive is.
Gotcha. That's fair.
Because I just don't know.
Yeah.
And then the deeper part of me says, and then That question becomes, it depends on the person. So there could be an array of motives across the variety of people who hold to this kind of a view.
Certainly, that is indeed fair.
So I just want to be careful about generalizing about it, which is why, this is a principle that does carry over for a layperson, which is, that's why you have to go person by person and case by case in your interactions with people.
Gotcha. Well, that makes absolute sense. We all are individuals with a lot of different presuppositions and biases that we bring to the table. I thought I'd ask you in closing, Dr. Bach, about the role of the historian today. We've been talking about how we do history, and no historian has been present for these things. But I wondered in the dialogue, whether it's theological or historical, this idea of history and theology sort of being able to be separated. It seems some of the question material that I've read that there's obviously the debate between the historical and the theological Jesus, as Dale's book suggests, that there's a line of demarcation that we can easily draw between what is historical and what is theological, as if we could separate them. It seems like there's kind of an artificial idea of separating the two. But to me, it seems like if Jesus is God in flesh and comes and lives and dwells among us, as John says, it seems like it would be a precarious, if not an outright impossible task to separate history from theology. Is that a valid concern or question?
Even a mistake, but here's the problem. And that is, when I'm interacting with someone who isn't there, I've got the question of how in the world do I get them to even think about the possibility?
Mm.
So you'll notice I'm doing something pretty consistently. I am flipping the questions the way we normally think about them.
Yeah.
Okay. We're thinking about them from the standpoint of our agenda and what our lenses are and the way we see the world. But I'm talking to someone who doesn't share all that space and doesn't share that lens and doesn't share that perspective. So my challenge is, how do I help them create categories they currently may not have?
Hmm.
Great. And how do I bring them across that bridge? The way I'm going to do it to start off with is I'm going to start with categories that they do work with and do process and do think about, and see if I can at least open the door and the crack for saying, you know what? And this isn't all that there is to it. There could be something else. You know, when you think about the evidence for the empty tomb, for what motivated the disciples, for the conversion of Saul to Paul, et cetera, all of a sudden there comes a pretty long wait that comes down that says, you know, all the other explanations that have been given for this are also quite problematic. If you think miracles are problematic, these other explanations are clueless. I mean, so then that puts the miracle discussion back on the table.
Yeah. Right.
And so I'm working backwards as I think about my apologetics. I'm thinking through, where is that person who I'm interacting with? Where are they coming from? What categories do they have? What's driving them? And so it's turning me into a listener to them a little more. And as I engage with them and I see how they see the world, et cetera, I'm beginning to ask the question, all right, what bridges can I build that will open up a conversation that will take them in a direction that allows me to raise the things that I'm aware of that they may not be aware of.
Absolutely. I know as being in the field of formal apologetics, I always constantly have to remind myself to be a listener as much as I do proclaim and say things, to understand the intellectual furniture of the person with whom I'm dialoguing.
And sometimes it's hard for people, for a particular lay person who isn't used to having to think this way or think about this quite so much. It's sometimes hard for us to put on someone else's worldview.
Right.
Because we're so embedded and immersed in our own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Final question here, and I know it could probably take up an hour conversation, but we'll let you go with this one. I'm thinking of, in terms of for the Christian camp here, we're talking about the reliability of the Gospels and historians. And I know that in our theology and our confession that God is a three-person God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And I'm thinking of John 14:26, where Jesus is talking about the Holy Spirit bringing to mind all the things that Jesus had said. So how can we as Christians, is I will say this, and I already know the answer kind of in a sense, but I'm interested to see what you might say. How can we look at the Holy Spirit as the, capital T-H-E, historian for us as believers? Or is that even a...
Well, ultimately, when we make the statement that the Bible is the Word of God, et cetera, that's what we're saying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we're saying that behind this is an authority and an awareness.
Okay? Yeah.
Of what took place that's being expressed, and is superintending the way the human authors expressed what they are describing.
Mm.
So, I mean, that's theologically where we're coming from. Now, here's the flip side of this. If that's so, then we ought to be able to make a case on the grounds of what we have, at least. That goes in a direction that can show that what is taking place in the text is coherent.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I can do it with, I can try and do it as much as I can, as much as is possible, because I'm also dealing with limited data. Do it in a way that appeals to categories that people can process without the theological explanation. So for me, the ability to kind of separate theology from history can be a benefit in certain conversations with the person who doesn't have a theological bone in their body.
Mm. Mm. So, in a nod to Dale a little bit, we do have to have a theologically informed imagination of some kind, at least even if we're trying to just put ourselves in the other person's shoes, we have to imagine a way to create concepts that they can understand.
And so I'm saying to them things like, you know, you really have two choices in life. You either are here as a biological and historical accident, and there's no explanation for why you're here, or there's something designed that puts you here. There is, you know, and now I'm building the bridge towards the image of God in people. I'm either made in the image of God, or else I'm left with the task of defining and identifying who I am as a person. And so I'm not surprised that the world has ended up trying to figure out and self-identify who they are if they're not connected to the living God. That's the natural place to go.
Excellent. Final thoughts, sir, and we'll wrap it up here.
I hope that what we've done is have you think about some categories of engagement that maybe you haven't thought about before. There's a whole nother conversation to have about what do we do in the period between when Jesus did what he did and it got inscripturated. That is a space that generates a lot of discussion in scholarly circles and creates a lot of debate. And it also is a place where a lot of the seeds are planted to create doubt.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As I've said to some skeptic friends of mine, who tell me that eyewitness testimony is unreliable, I ask them, are you an eyewitness to that?
You've been listening to Apologetics Profile, a podcast ministry of Watchman Fellowship Incorporated. For more information about our ministry and resources, visit our website at watchman.org.